Look at a solid block of steel, just, sitting there on a table. It's room temperature, it's rigid, and incredibly heavy. If you want to change the internal architecture of that metal, your brain naturally tells you that you have to melt it down. You assume you need a massive furnace, glowing red liquid metal, and like a mold to pour it into.
Right, which makes perfect sense. I mean, that's the traditional intuitive view of how solids behave. You add extreme heat to make the atoms mobile enough to break their bonds and sort of rearrange themselves into something new.
But you don't actually have to melt it. That solid block of steel can completely rewire its internal architecture, entirely changing its physical properties without ever turning into a liquid. It undergoes this total structural metamorphosis while remaining completely solid to the touch.
It really sounds like a magic trick, but it's actually one of the most fascinating phenomena in material science. It totally defies our basic intuition about what solid matter is capable of doing.
And that is exactly our mission for you today on this deep dive into the source material. We're looking at a stack of highly technical sources, including excerpts from the authoritative textbook Bainite in Steels and several advanced metallurgical papers. And they're all focused on one incredibly misunderstood marvel of metallurgy, which is bainite.
Yeah, bainite is just incredible.
It really is. So today we're going to unravel the fuzzy logic of how this microscopic structure forms inside solid steel and exactly why it's the secret ingredient behind everything from the giant wind turbines outside your city to the crash bars inside your car doors.
It's the perfect topic to dig into. To really set the scene here, we need to think about a temperature chart. Imagine the extreme ends, right, at very high temperatures, say above 800 degrees Celsius. All the atoms in a block of steel are highly mobile. They're buzzing around, diffusing freely, swapping places. Then at the other extreme, at very low temperatures, everything is frozen perfectly in place. Nothing moves. But in the middle, in this intermediate zone between 250 and 550 degrees Celsius, the normal rules completely break down.
This is what we're calling the fuzzy logic zone. But before we get into what happens there, we should probably name our characters. Okay. What is the steel starting out as, and what is it trying to become?
Good point. So when the steel is at that really high temperature with all its atoms flowing and mingling freely, metallurgists call that parent metal austenite. It has the specific open crystal structure. But as it cools down, it wants to change into a new, more stable room temperature structure called ferrite.
Okay, so we have austenite trying to become ferrite. And steel is essentially just a mix of two things, right? Massive iron atoms and tiny carbon atoms hiding in the empty spaces between those iron atoms.
Exactly. Now, let's go back to that intermediate fuzzy logic zone, that 250 to 550 degree window. In this specific temperature band, you have a totally bizarre situation. The tiny carbon atoms still have enough thermal energy to zip around and diffuse, but the large iron atoms, they're sluggish.
They're just too big.
Yeah, they don't have enough energy to break their bonds and rebuild a new structure piece by piece. So instead of flowing into a new shape, the iron atoms just, well, they just shift.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because to really grasp how bainite eventually creates such incredible real-world materials, mm-hmm. we first have to visualize this strange atomic dance. It's like a crowded dance floor.
Yeah, I like that analogy.
Yeah, so at high temperatures, the song is fast. And everyone is mingling freely, walking past each other across the room. At freezing temperatures, the music stops, and everyone is stuck perfectly in place. But in this bainite zone, the big, heavy dancers, the iron atoms, can't walk across the room anymore. So they just shift their weight in a highly coordinated, synchronized step to the left, while the tiny, fast dancers, the carbon atoms, are still zipping through the gaps between them.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. In metallurgy, that coordinated step is called a displacive mechanism. At high temperatures, transformations are reconstructive, meaning the atoms diffuse and rebuild the structure bond by bond, like tearing down a Lego house and building a new one.
Right, taking it apart completely.
Exactly. But the growth of bainite is displacive. It's a highly coordinated, military-like movement. The entire austenite lattice literally shears and bends itself into the new ferrite crystal structure all at once.
But that synchronized shifting is not gentle at all.
Mm-hmm.
Reading the data in these papers, it actually creates a massive physical shape deformation inside the solid metal.
Massive is definitely the right word. The data shows a shear strain of 0.24 and a volume strain of 0.03.
Wait, what do those numbers actually mean physically for the steel? Like for those of us who aren't engineers?
Think of it this way. To accomplish this shift, the newly forming bainite has to physically bulldoze the surrounding untransformed austenite out of the way. The strain energy required to do this is immense. It's around 400 joules per mole.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's the microscopic equivalent of a massive car crash happening inside the solid metal. The parent metal is being violently warped and stretched as this new structure forces its way into existence.
What's wild to me is that this is happening on a scale so small we can't even see it, but the violence of it is what gives the metal its strength.
Right, and what's fascinating here is that this exact coordinated shifting, this intense internal pressure and strain, is quite literally forging the steel from the inside out. It is what makes the steel in your car both tough enough to take an impact and strong enough not to snap.
But because of this intense microscopic car crash, the bainite can't just grow infinitely. The parent steel physically fights back. Which brings us to the actual architecture of the metal, these structures called sheaves and subunits.
Right. Because the bainite is bulldozing its way through, it grows in the form of incredibly thin plates, which the literature calls subunits. And when we say thin, we mean about 0.2 micrometers thick.
Just to give you a sense of scale, a human hair is about 100 micrometers thick. So we're talking about something literally finer than the wavelength of visible light.
Precisely. You can't even see these individual plates with a standard optical microscope. You need a high-powered electron microscope just to find them. And these tiny subunits group together into parallel clusters called sheaves.
See, I had a huge question when I was reading this part. If the structure is just shifting in this coordinated military step, why doesn't a single plate just cascade and transform the whole block of steel at once? Like, what actually forces it to stop growing at just 0.2 micrometers?
It stops because the surrounding steel yields to the pressure. The boundary between the newly growing bainite plate and the old austenite is what we call a glissal interface. Glissal just means it's capable of sliding smoothly. But as it slides and shears the austenite around it, the surrounding metal undergoes intense plastic deformation. It literally gets crushed.
And that crushing creates debris, right?
Exactly. Microscopic defect debris, which metallurgists call dislocations. This defect debris builds up right at the boundary of the growing plate. The interface between the old and new steel becomes so cluttered and tangled with this wreckage that the plate is physically blocked from growing any further. The glissal interface is completely stifled.
It's like an earthquake fault line. The fault slips, releasing all this energy, but then it hits a massive, immovable wall of solid bedrock beneath the surface. The slip simply can't go any further.
Yes, but the tectonic pressure is still pushing. So because the first slip hit a wall, the stress transfers, forcing a brand new parallel slip to happen right next to it.
So the first subunit hits that wall of dislocation debris and stops dead. But the thermodynamic driving force, the desire to turn into ferrite, is still there.
Right. So a new subunit nucleates right at the tip or the side of the first one. It grows, hits its own wall of debris, and stops. And then another one starts, and another. This repetitive stopping and starting is what creates that sheaf structure we mentioned. It's an organized, layered cluster of tiny interrupted platelets rather than one giant continuous sheet of metal.
And this chaotic maze of interrupted plates is exactly what we want, right? Because it acts as a trap for cracks.
Exactly. It completely refines the effective grain size of the metal. If a crack tries to propagate through the steel, say, from an impact, it can't just slice through cleanly. It has to navigate this chaotic labyrinth of tiny individual subunits constantly changing direction that requires a massive amount of energy, which stops the crack in its tracks.
So we have the heavy iron atoms shifting, bulldozing the way forward, and locking into these tiny plates. But what about those fast dancers? The tiny carbon atoms zipping around the dance floor. Because from the sources, the speed of the carbon dictates the entire identity of the bainite. It's a literal race.
It is a race between the growing plate and the escaping carbon. And the outcome depends entirely on the exact temperature within that 250 to 550 degree fuzzy logic window. This gives us two distinctly different types of steel, which are upper bainite and lower bainite.
Let's start with upper bainite, which forms at the hotter end of the temperature range, between 400 and 550 degrees Celsius.
At these higher temperatures, the carbon atoms are moving very rapidly. As the new ferrite plates shift into existence, the carbon diffuses out of them almost immediately. The ferrite physically rejects the carbon. So this rejected carbon pools in the untransformed austenite sitting between the plates. Eventually, the carbon concentration gets so high in those gaps that it chemically reacts with the iron to form coarse particles of a ceramic-like compound called cementite.
And from an engineering perspective, coarse cementite is kind of the ultimate villain of the story.
Oh, it absolutely is. Coarse cementite particles are notoriously brittle. They're prime locations for starting what we call cleavage cracks. Think of a cleavage crack like splitting a piece of firewood along the grain with an axe. Once it starts, it just zips right through with almost no resistance.
Yikes.
Yeah, if you put upper bainite under too much physical stress, those big cementite particles between the plates will snap, and that cleavage crack will spread rapidly through the steel, causing a catastrophic sudden failure.
Right, and nobody wants their car bumper to shatter like glass. But then, we drop the temperature, we enter the lower bainite zone between 250 and 400 degrees Celsius, and the carbon atoms finally slow down.
And the entire race changes. At lower temperatures, the carbon moves sluggishly. The time it takes to reject the carbon into the surrounding area becomes much longer than the time it takes for carbides to precipitate. So the carbon gets physically trapped inside the newly formed ferrite plates.
And because it's trapped inside the plates rather than pooling outside of them, it precipitates right there as incredibly fine nanoscale particles.
Yes, we get transition carbides or fine cementite that is just a few nanometers thick. Because these particles are so incredibly small, and because they're distributed evenly throughout the inside of the plates rather than clumped up as brittle walls between them, lower bainite is vastly superior. It's significantly tougher, much stronger, and much more resistant to cracking than upper bainite.
Now, here's where it gets really interesting. I was looking at the actual experiments they ran to prove all of this. Because it's one thing to theorize that carbon is getting trapped, but how do you actually see a single carbon atom trapped inside a steel lattice? The methodology here is just mind-blowing.
Oh, you're talking about the atom probe data. I love this part of the research. Mm. An atom probe is an instrument that is almost science fiction. You take a microscopic needle-like sample of the steel, put it in a vacuum, and hit it with high-voltage electrical pulses. It literally rips the atoms off the tip of the needle one by one and fires them at a detector to map their exact three-dimensional positions.
Atom by atom.
Atom by atom. And when they use this probe on bainite, they discovered that initially the carbon is trapped inside the ferrite at concentrations far, far above what thermodynamic laws say is possible. The metal is supersaturated.
The carbon is literally trapped in a space where physics says it shouldn't be able to exist.
Exactly. The carbon is forced into one specific sublattice of the empty spaces between the iron. And because there's so much of it trapped in there, it actually warps the crystal structure. Instead of a normal symmetrical cubic shape, the trapped carbon forces the iron unit cell to stretch into a tetragonal shape like a cube that's been pulled from the top and bottom.
Wow.
It only relaxes back to a cube later if the carbon eventually manages to escape. That warped tetragonal shape is a profound physical vestige of that initial military-like shifting we talked about.
It's incredible that we can see the literal microscopic footprints of this atomic struggle. But this trapped carbon leads to another absolutely crazy phenomenon in the fuzzy logic zone. Mm-hmm. The transformation just stops. It hits an invisible thermodynamic wall.
Right. As the tiny bainite plates grow, they do manage to reject some carbon into the surrounding austenite parent metal. As a result, that remaining austenite becomes heavily enriched with carbon.
It's like trying to dissolve sugar into a glass of cold iced tea. You stir and stir, and at first the sugar dissolves into the water. But eventually the tea just says no more, and the sugar starts piling up at the bottom of the glass. The reaction is completely unfinished, but it won't go any further no matter how much you stir.
Yes. And normal high-temperature thermodynamics tells us we should be able to dissolve that sugar if we just wait long enough for the atoms to diffuse. But with bainite, the tea essentially freezes over before the sugar can fully dissolve. It just gives up. In metallurgy, this is known as the incomplete reaction phenomenon. The transformation of austenite to bainite completely halts when the carbon concentration in the surrounding austenite hits an invisible boundary known as the T0 curve.
The T0 curve. Let's make sure we define exactly why that wall exists.
The T0 curve is the exact thermodynamic point where the free energy of the new bainite and the free energy of the old austenite become completely identical. Think of it like a boulder rolling down a hill. For a transformation to continue, the new state needs to have lower energy than the old state the boulder wants to reach the bottom. But the T0 curve is like a perfectly flat plateau halfway down the hill. Once the energies are equal, the driving force drops to zero. The boulder stops rolling. The reaction just gives up.
Even though the steel hasn't reached its normal final equilibrium.
Exactly. Normal thermodynamic equilibrium is defined by a totally different line on the chart called the AE3 curve. But bainite never reaches it. It stops well short at the T0 curve. And this is the ultimate, undeniable proof that bainite grows through that displacive, shifting mechanism, not by normal reconstructive diffusion.
Because if it was diffusion, it would keep going.
Right. If the atoms were freely diffusing, the reaction would keep going until it hit the final A3 equilibrium. But because it relies on this coordinated shifting, it is bound by the strict thermodynamic limits of the T0 curve. Once the energy plateaus, the shifting is mathematically forbidden from continuing.
Okay, so we've got heavy iron atoms bulldozing into new shapes, racing carbon atoms, warping crystal lattices, subunits finer than light being stifled by their own microscopic wreckage, and thermodynamic walls stopping reactions halfway. This is all incredible, mind-bending science, but how does it actually leave the laboratory? How do engineers actually use this fuzzy logic in the real world?
Well, they hack the recipe. Once material scientists fully understood the incomplete reaction and the dangerous role of carbon pulling up, they realized they could intentionally manipulate the alloy to force the steel into doing exactly what they wanted.
It really is modern alchemy.
Precisely. Let's take the cementite problem in upper bainite. We know those coarse cementite particles cause catastrophic cleavage cracks. So engineers started adding elements like silicon or aluminum to the steel mix, usually just a little over 1%.
Wait, how does adding just a pinch of silicon solve the cracking problem?
Silicon completely suppresses the formation of cementite. It's chemically insoluble in cementite, so it acts like a microscopic roadblock. By entirely stopping the brittle cementite from forming, the carbon is forced to just stay in the surrounding austenite. This perfectly stabilizes that austenite so it survives all the way down to room temperature.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, what you end up with is a composite material made of tough bainitic fairy plates woven together with carbon-enriched austenite. You get incredible strength and no brittle cementite to crack under pressure.
Okay, I saw the other chemical recipes in the papers, and I honestly thought there was a typo in the data. They add 0.0002% boron. How does something that minuscule physically alter a massive, heavy block of solid steel?
It seems impossible, but it is remarkably potent. That tiny fraction of boron segregates directly to the boundaries of the austenite grains. By coating those specific boundaries, the boron essentially poisons the starting line for normal high-temperature ferrite. It chemically shuts down the standard transformation pathways,
leaving the door open for bainite.
Exactly. This leaves the door wide open for pure bainite to form later as the steel cools. It's a massive breakthrough because it allows engineers to create huge, fully bainitic components without having to rely on intense, rapid cooling.
Which brings us to the real-world superpowers. So what does this all mean for you listening right now? Well, next time you turn on a light, you're relying on this exact atomic dance.
Yes, the global energy sector relies heavily on what is called granular bainite. They use it to build massive creep-resistant turbines and power generation rotors. These are giant metal components that spin continuously, running at 560 degrees Celsius for 25 years straight. The bainitic structure is so inherently stable that it resists warping, or what we call creeping, under those extreme punishing conditions for decades.
And it's literally in the doors of our cars, protecting us on the highway.
Oh, automotive manufacturing has been completely revolutionized by the nitic forging alloys. Take a camshaft inside your engine or the crash reinforcement bar inside your car door. In the past, to make those parts strong enough to save your life, you had to forge normal steel, heat it up to extreme temperatures, quench it violently in a bath of water or oil to harden it, temper it in another furnace so it wasn't brittle, and then physically bend it back into shape because the violent quenching process warped the metal.
That sounds wildly expensive and just a massive waste of energy and time.
It was a massive bottleneck. But by hacking the recipe with silicon and boron to form bainite, the manufacturer can just stamp the hot part in a press and literally just leave it to cool naturally in the air. As it cools, the fuzzy logic takes over, the microscopic subunits shift into place, the carbon gets trapped, and you get the perfect, ultra-strong microstructure directly from the die.
No violent quenching.
No violent quenching, no secondary tempering, no physical straightening. It saves the industry massive amounts of time, energy, and money while keeping you safe.
And then there's the ultimate hack.
Yeah.
The absolute cutting edge of this science nanostructured bainite.
This is where it all culminates. By perfectly balancing the carbon and the silicon and letting the steel transform at the absolute lowest possible end of the bainite temperature zone, sometimes letting it sit there for days or even weeks just to finish the transformation, they create plates of ferrite that are just tens of nanometers thick.
Tens of nanometers. We went from thinner than light to barely thicker than a cluster of atoms.
Yes, and because the subunits are so unimaginably small, the maze that stops the cracks is incredibly dense. The result is an ultra-high-strength steel with a strength rating greater than 2,000 megapascals. It is used for advanced military armor and high-performance aerospace bearings. And all they did to achieve that was let the iron atoms shift naturally at a low temperature and let the thermodynamics do the work.
Okay, let's bring this all together. Bainite is this magical, misunderstood middle ground of phase transformations. It's not the free-flowing reconstructive diffusion of high heat, and it's not the frozen rigidity of deep cold. It's born of shifting iron bulldozing its way forward and raising carbon atoms warping the very crystal they're trapped inside. It stunts its own growth through physical strain, creating microscopic, impenetrable labyrinths of subunits. And by understanding this fuzzy logic by adding just a pinch of silicon or a microscopic dusting of boron, engineers have harnessed an incomplete reaction to literally build the modern world.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you know, Bainite shows us that a material's ultimate strength doesn't always come from finishing a process. Often, the power comes from stopping a reaction halfway through. It is the incomplete reaction, the stifled growth, that gives it its resilience. It raises a really important, provocative question for the future of materials science.
What's that?
What other incredible properties are hiding in other metals or even plastics and ceramics if we can just figure out how to freeze their atomic transformations right in the middle of their own fuzzy intermediate zones?
That is a brilliant question for the next generation of modern alchemists to figure out. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Remember that solid block of steel sitting on the table? The next time you look at one, remember that under the right conditions, without ever melting, a microscopic, military-like dance can completely rewrite its destiny from the inside out. Keep your curiosity sharp, and we will catch you on the next one.